This week, the Federal Reserve raised rates by another 25 basis points. That's a quarter of a percentage point. Fed Chair Jay Powell saying that he believes that the banking crisis is likely over. JP Morgan's Jamie Dimon also echoing this statement as well. However, our Chief Investment Officer, Financial Sense Wealth Management, posted a video this week talking about why the banking crisis is likely not over. So we're going to discuss that today. So Chris, let's just start off with the main topic here. Why do you think that the banking crisis is likely not over yet?
Because the cause of the crisis has not been removed. And a lot of people, basically, the banks kind of came front and center in terms of the news with the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank in March. But the seeds for this crisis were sown, a long time before that. Part of it was, banks have a securities portfolio and a lot of it is in fixed income and longer dated. So they obviously took a huge hit with the Fed raising rates aggressively. So that's part of it, is that, they've taken a hit on their assets. But to me, the more important part was that when you look at the entire U.S. banking industry, so all commercial banks in the U.S., regardless of size, total deposits peaked last year. And they peaked right around the time when the Fed started raising interest rates. So the Fed is actually behind this issue that we are seeing. So for banks right now, their problem is, do you try to stop deposit outflow or do you try to maintain profitability? So for banks to maintain profitability, they want to pay lenders and depositors a low rate of interest while charging a higher one. But however, the issue that we're having is as the Fed began to raise interest rates off of zero, banks more or less are still at zero for the most part. And what you're seeing is a progressive move away from banks in terms of total deposit outflow. And people are doing the rational thing. It's exactly what, Charlie Munger said, show me the incentive and I'll tell you the outcome. Well, the incentive is for people to pull their money from their bank, earning practically zero, and getting a higher rate of interest on a treasury, T-bill or money market that invests in T-bills. And with the Fed now paying over 5% with its rate hike this week, there is a huge gap between FDIC average depositors' savings rates versus what you can get on a T-bill. So that's exactly what consumers are doing. I mean, think about it. If you have $100,000 sitting at your bank, paying you basically zero, I mean, your 1099 is kind of an annoyance, versus buying a treasury and getting $5,000 in income, it's a no-brainer. And so we have seen a consistent and steady outflow of deposits since the spring of 22. Then we had Silicon Valley Bank blow up. And that was a massive, very short, acute depositor flight that really hurt that bank. But what we've seen, what we've heard is that, this is just, small banks that are dealing with this and the large banks are fine. They'll probably benefit as people pull their deposits and go to larger banks. No, they're not. They're not benefiting. As I mentioned, if you break out large and small commercial banks, the small commercial banks actually were seeing their deposit base basically flatline, while large commercial banks were seeing their deposits begin to decline. It was only with the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank this year, we finally started to see sizable withdrawals of deposits from small commercial banks. So large banks are not benefiting from this. They're also seeing depositor flight. The issue that we have is, think about it in this way. When you pull money from a bank, they can't lend that out and create loans. So you give a bank a dollar of deposits, they'll take that and make, $10 of loans, or they might invest in securities and leverage your deposit. But when this movie is playing in reverse, this is not how our system and the economy was designed. Banks are designed for a positive yield curve, which a positive yield curve means that short-term rates are lower than long-term rates. And that's what banks do. They borrow short and they lend long, so they capture that profit margin. Banks don't operate when you have an inverted yield curve. They basically have negative profit margins. And our economy lives and breathes on credit. So when you pull your deposit from your bank, you're taking away that credit machine that commercial banks in the economy rely on. They're not making loans with your deposit, and instead they're calling loans or they're letting loans mature and not making new ones. Or how are they meeting your deposit? So if you go into your bank and you demand your money because you're going to pull it out and put it in T-bill or take it somewhere else, how do they meet your deposit outflow? They do that by either selling securities, cash on hand, or as loans are paid off and mature and they get their money back, they pay through that way. But what we have seen, and this is, to me, Chris, what is really surprising We've got data going back to the early 70s. And this was something I showed, is when you look at commercial bank deposits, this is the entire U.S. commercial bank industry, year over year, bank outflow of deposits is 4.7% year over year. That is the steepest decline in the history of the data that I have going back to the early 70s. Even in 2008, the biggest financial crisis since the Great Depression, we saw positive commercial bank deposit flow. Now, what is a corollary to deposit flow is commercial bank securities in terms of their market value. So what we can see is that as deposits began to decelerate, so too did the growth in commercial bank securities. Commercial bank securities year over year are down 10%. So clearly commercial banks are selling assets to meet depositor redemptions, and it's also going to restrict loans and lending activity. And that's what I see ahead, is that we are going to still have a credit crunch as banks tighten lending standards and they tighten credit availability to basically go into, you know, the bunker and prepare for this downturn. Now, as I mentioned, the deposit outflow began last spring when the Fed began to raise interest rates and created a wider and wider spread between what you could get paid on a T-bill versus what your bank's paying you. Now, here's the key. Even if the Fed no longer raises interest rates, that does nothing for the spread between a T-bill and your bank. What we have to see to compress that is one of three things. Either commercial banks need to finally suffer their profit margins by raising deposit rates that they're paying their customers, or we need to see the Federal Reserve cut interest rates, or both, where banks raise and the Fed cuts to squash that margin and take away the incentive to pull your deposit. And what the Fed has clearly said, with inflation well above 2%, that when you look at their forecast, they have no plans to cut rates anytime soon. However, as early as yesterday, the market was pricing in, I think, around anywhere from a 10 to 20% chance that the Federal Reserve cuts interest rates in their next meeting in June. So the market is clearly discounting rate cuts by the Fed, and the Fed is saying, no, we are on hold, basically. The Fed has no forecast of any rate cuts down the line. So as long as that spread is large between short-term rates and what your bank is paying you, I think we'll see the average bank customer do the rational thing, which is invest and earn interest. I mean, consider, you know, if you're a wealthier client, you have $1 million in various banks. Imagine what you could earn by just putting in a T-bill. You'd get $50,000 in income. Now, the other thing too is there's also a tax advantage. So states do not tax federal interest. Basically, T-bills are single tax free, while the interest that your bank pays you is doubly taxed. So there's also a tax advantage by buying T-bills. So, that incentive is still there, which is why I do not think that the banking crisis is behind us. I think it's still very much front and center.
And I know that you track a number of these different figures in Bloomberg on a daily basis, and we've shown a number of these in the weekly investment meetings that we post on YouTube and our website. But again, just to summarize some of the points that you made, I mean, we still see that the yield curve is inverted. Short rates are higher than long rates, which means that's putting pressure on bank margins. And we typically see the yield curve invert prior to every recession. And we are currently very inverted if you look at the 10-year minus the 2-year treasury. So that's a warning sign. That's putting pressure on the banking system. Bank deposits are continuing to fall. So you've been showing that data and you're tracking that we see from both regional banks and the larger commercial banks. People are still pulling their money out. That's what we've been doing at our company. We're doing exactly what other people are doing by managing corporate cash balances to earn a higher yield than what they were earning at the bank, basically earning very little. So that's what we've been doing at our company for clients. And then we see banks are rapidly tightening up on lending standards, pulling back on the number of loans being made, which is also something that we see moving into a recession, which we believe is probably going to end up happening in the second half of this year. So all these factors, like you pointed out, these are all the conditions that led up to the current banking crisis. And none of them, perhaps other than the Fed maybe pausing here, is the one of those many that have become a little less troublesome in the short term. But again, the broader landscape here is still pointing towards this idea that the banking crisis is likely not over, or there's still going to be some turmoil ahead.
I very much agree that this bank crisis is not behind us. Now, the concern that I have is when you have this as a negative backdrop, a banking issue in our U.S. system, is throwing on top of that other bad news. And in terms of bad news, I think we're headed into a very weak period ahead. There's the Wall Street axiom of sell in May and go away. And what that's referring to is that returns in the market historically have been fairly poor between May and September. And a lot of the big market bottoms over the last 100 years have often occurred in October. And we typically see a more favorable period for the market between October and April. You've got the Santa Claus rally at the end of the year. You have the strong seasonal sales period, retail sales for Christmas. And then you typically have a lot of influx of new money coming in at the start of the year from pensions and 401ks and so forth that also kind of get deployed in the market. And what I wanted to show, though, Chris, was what influences that trend of weak prices in the middle of the year. And what I was showing was that the business cycle, or what the economy is doing, has a major influence on the impact of returns during the normal sell in May and go away. So for example, I've got data going back to 1960 through 2022. And what we find is that between October and April, again, this is the strong seasonal period, markets up about 7.9% on average. Between May and September, going back to 1960, during that weak period, the market is only up 0.4% on average. So a huge drop off in your return. Now, with that average data in mind, what I wanted to see was the influence of the business cycle during those two key periods. So I looked at periods in which the Conference Board's leading economic indicator was rising and periods in which the Conference Board's LEI was falling. And what I found is that when you look at the normal period of October to April, again, stated previously, you're up for an average return of 7.9. During that same period, if the LEIs are rising, your average return goes from 7.9 to 10.3. Now let's look at the opposite. What happens if the economy is slowing? Well, your returns drop dramatically from 7.9 on average return of October through April to 0.9 if the LEIs are falling. So a huge hit, even in that normal strong seasonal period. So imagine having a weak seasonal period with a weak economy. So the double negative. And what we found is the poor period of returns between May and September. If the LEIs are falling, your returns actually turn negative, of negative 6%, with a median negative return of 7.5%. So what we see is that the strong periods of return or weak periods of return are strongly influenced by the direction of the LEIs. The reason why I bring this up and why I want you to do this study is we are now officially, obviously, in May. And what I wanted to see is what the LEIs are likely to do. And one of the best predictors of LEIs is the change in interest rates over a two-year period, which has a pretty strong tendency to lead the market. So for example, when we look at the dramatic rise in the 10-year Treasury yield over the last 24 months, it's basically projecting that the Conference Board's LEI will likely fall for the remainder of this year and through the first quarter of next year, and finally bottom sometime in the second quarter of 2024. So based on the data of looking at the leading relationship of interest rates and how they trickle down and influence the economy, and that's something too the Fed has talked about and others have brought up to the Fed during the press conferences, is the long and variable lag of monetary policy before it hits the economy. So the economy is already slowing and we still had the Fed raising rates this week. So we're going to feel the impact of the Fed's rate hike this week going even until next year. This is why the LEIs are likely to fall for the remainder of this year. Now, as I stated previously, during May through September, when the LEIs are falling, typically returns are negative in the low single digits of 6 to 7 to 8% loss. So this is why our firm remains defensive, Chris. We've basically still believe there's a recession on the horizon. The catalysts for a strong economy are just not there. We have the Fed again tightening. We have the economy and credit contracting, and this is why we think this could be a rough and choppy summer for the markets ahead.
What would you want to see to turn bullish on the market?
I would want to see depositor flight at least stabilize. And I think really, Chris, as I mentioned, the only way we're going to get there is if the Federal Reserve starts to cut interest rates, which I do expect. We got the jobs report today, which surprised on the upside. However, the prior 2 months were revised down, I think, around 150,000 jobs. So, clearly we're having an issue in which the non-farm payrolls data is being overstated And a big part of that, Chris, is the birth-death model. So basically, when you look backwards and you're driving a car and you're looking in your rearview mirror, you're invariably going to miss the turn. And that's what happens when you have a model that just projects forward by looking backwards. It's going to miss the turns. And when you look at temp employment, jobless claims trending higher, everything is saying the jobs market is weaker than what non-farm payrolls are showing. So we're still very much in the recession camp. We think recession lays ahead of us. And until we see the economy stabilize, we see the Fed reverse course and act as a tailwind instead of a headwind for the markets, we're going to remain on the sidelines.
And that was something that Anna Wong, that we spoke to this week, also said, that she thought that the official data, especially on the jobs numbers, that they were overstating the strength of the jobs market because of some of those calculations there, and that she expects pretty significant weakening through the second half of this year. But basically, chief U.S. economist at Bloomberg aligning with much of what we've been discussing here on our show. Again, we would also want to see leading economic indicators turn up. We'd want to see the yield curve uninvert from its current inverted status. And we'd want to see a number of these other things also move from headwinds to tailwinds for the market. And we're just not there yet. Chris, on that note, would you mind telling our listeners about some of the services that we provide here at Financial Sense Wealth Management?
Sure. We provide a whole host of financial services. We provide financial planning, wealth management. We also do 401k servicing, consulting, and we also assist corporations in managing their cash balance.
If any of our listeners would like to get in touch with our financial advisors, what would be the best way to do so?
They can give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Chris, it was a pleasure speaking with you again on Smart Macro. We look forward to speaking with you in another 2 weeks.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.